Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Who doesn't love making lists? I make lists all the time. Usually it's to remember what I'm supposed to get from the store, because even though I can remember esoteric things in physics or in ancient Greek lexicons, I can still never remember to get the milk when I'm supposed to be at the store. But today is about lists. Lists with the arguments for the existence of God. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today I'm actually a guest on the Practical Theism podcast with Josh Smith. So Josh is interviewing me for his podcast and asked me to rank the arguments for the existence of God. Now, I'm not ranking all of them. I wanted just to give Josh an example in this podcast, arguments that I consider to be lower tier when it comes to effectiveness, mid-tier when it comes to effectiveness, and high-tier when it comes to effectiveness at communicating the existence of God to others. We only barely scratched the surface. We just covered a few of the arguments, so much more we could have discussed. If you would like to hear me discuss arguments for the existence of God at length, strap yourselves in, because in a few months, Catholic Answers will be releasing one of my newest courses for the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics. It's going to be a whole course on evidence for the existence of God, probably about a 6-hour course on the arguments for and against God, the ways to understand the divine attributes, the reasonableness of religion, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Lots of great stuff. I'm really excited for that full-length course. And you should check out the other courses there, too. The courses that Jimmy Akin does are stupendous, by the way. He does Introduction to Apologetics. It's really good. You need to go check it out at schoolofapologetics.com. If you're interested, I have a course there on... I have two courses. I have one on evidence for Catholic moral teaching and another on the doctrine of creation from nothing. But I have two more courses that are going to join soon. The one on atheism, or the existence of God, that I just shared with you, and then another that is on pro-life. Well, specifically, it's on arguing against abortion, a whole course dedicated to teaching you how to dismantle pro-choice arguments in a gracious way. I'll let you guys know on the podcast when that will be out, though I will let you know that our patrons will get a sneak peek of some aspect of the courses at trenthornpodcast.com. If you want access to that and other bonus content, like my weekly catechism study series that airs Monday at 8 a.m. Every week, you can check that out. Become a subscriber at trenthornpodcast.com. And now, without further ado, here's my interview with Josh Smith for the Practical Theism Podcast. Go and check it out, Practical Theism Podcast, where we talk about ranking the arguments for the existence of God.
First off, in looking at arguments for God's existence, I found many people, they potentially hear argument for God's existence and they find it lacking in some way. Like, it doesn't get them all the way there to believing that God exists. So I'm curious, from your perspective and the conversations you've had over the years, are arguments for God's existence intended to get to some objective, like deductive certainty that God exists? Why would you say so, or why not?
Right. So it depends on the kind of argument that you're putting forward. So in philosophy, there's really two kinds of arguments. There are deductive arguments and inductive arguments. So a deductive argument is one where you argue from universal truths to particular truths. So, you know, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. And you get 100% with deductive arguments, you get 100% certainty. That's what's great about them. The only downside with a deductive argument is that you only get that certainty if you're just as certain about the truths of the premises. So with the Socrates example, you know, we're really sure about those two premises. So the conclusion follows with, you know, logical certainty. But many other arguments for the existence of God that are, and many of them, in fact, the majority of the ones that I use in my book, are deductive in nature. Many atheists have problems. They say, well, it doesn't get me all the way there because I'm not 100% sold on this premise or that premise, or I'm not sure that the argument actually follows in the way you're putting forward. So that's one kind of argument for God. Another kind of argument for God, it's not as common in my books or work, but is very common among philosophers of religion, are called inductive arguments for the existence of God. So an inductive argument starts from a particular and it reasons to a universal. All the cats we have seen are black. All the cats we've observed, or let's say all the swans we have observed are white. Therefore, all swans are white. You know, most reasoning we do with scientific reasoning is inductive. Of course, that leads to the problem of induction, because you can't get 100% certainty with induction. I've been to Australia, for example, and I've seen black swans face to face. So Europeans might have been really sure that all swans are white. They didn't know about the black swans in Australia. It's, you know, the black swan problem. And so there are arguments that put forward that don't say, well, this argument proves God exists, but this evidence, this feature of the natural world is more likely or more expected if God did exist. These are inductive arguments. To compare them, deductive arguments are like the kind that maybe Thomas Aquinas would use, or even like William Lane Craig uses more deductive arguments, like the Kalam argument. Mm-hmm. Inductive arguments are more like what the philosopher Richard Swinburne uses. He takes more of an inductive approach, saying that when you look at the world around us, all of the evidence makes God's existence more likely than less likely. Two different kinds of arguments. I prefer the deductive ones because they tend to be simpler to articulate and for people to wrap their heads around. But you're right, some people, it's also hard when you share these arguments, especially if they're shared as proofs for the existence of God.
Yeah.
Some people might say, oh, well, I don't think God exists after listening to this. I'm not moved in that way. Now, the Catholic Church teaches we can know God exists through reason, but people don't always reason correctly. I think another problem that happens here is what I might call Napoleon Dynamite Syndrome. Did you ever see Napoleon Dynamite?
Oh, yeah.
Now, when that movie first came out, people told me, Trent, this is the funniest movie you'll ever see in your life. This is the funniest movie you will ever see in your life. I'm like, oh, wow, oh, I'm ready. And then I go and see it, and I'm like, it was funny, I guess. So it's
yeah.
Like it's not the funniest movie. So if you hype it up too much, like, this proves without beyond a doubt God exists, and then someone sees it, it's like, well, maybe. So I like to think of the proofs and arguments as signposts or things that make God more credible. Thomas Aquinas even referred to his five ways. He called them ways. You know, these are ways to God. And I don't think they will intellectually overpower people, but when people give them a fair shake, they have a serious prospect of leading someone through reason to the existence of God.
Yeah, you know, I was going to point that out too with Thomas Aquinas. He comes to mind, obviously. I think a lot of theistic philosophers, or just theists in general, when they start diving into arguments for God's existence, a lot go to Aquinas, right? They go to the contingency argument, you know, and they're put forward as kind of deductive, but he himself refers to them as paths.
Right.
And it kind of gets at a really interesting thought about God. Well, it's not, they're paths to God. They're an opportunity to encounter, but they're not exclusive. As if, like, God's a genie in a bottle that there's only one way to rub the lamp and you get to encounter the genie, right?
Right.
God's a bit more broad than what our mind would have us understand.
And actually, there is a newer book by a really good philosopher of religion named C. Stephen Evans that takes this kind of approach. It's called Natural Signs and Knowledge of God, A New Look at Theistic Arguments. And he talks about them as signs to God rather than these kind of overwhelming proofs. So that's another more recent look at that issue.
Awesome. Well, you know what? Let's dive into three arguments. I thought it'd be really good to dive into three arguments, some that you feel are maybe more effective and some that are probably a little bit less effective. And obviously some of your apologetic work in communicating with atheists and agnostics or people that are struggling with this question of does God exist? So let's start from the kind of bottom from your perspective, just in terms of what you feel has, you know, it's got some weight, but it's not, it doesn't get somebody really their brain turning in the way that you would think. The least effective argument for God's existence, what would you say that argument would be from your perspective?
Right. And I would say that this is my perspective. I think people are allowed to have many different perspectives on these arguments. Well, I would say for anyone, the most effective argument is the argument that moves you to believe that God exists. And for different people, those are going to be different kinds of arguments. Now, with that said, in my experience of engaging atheists or from speaking to people who have left atheism and come to believe in God and believe in the Christian faith, there are tends to be a similar kinds of arguments that move them and other kinds of arguments that I've rarely heard affect anyone. So that, I think, allows me to have a credible opinion on which arguments are less effective and which arguments are more effective. Now, where to pick the arguments? There's actually a lot of different arguments that are out there. A nice survey can be found in Peter Kraft and Ronald Tocelli's essay, 20 Proofs for the Existence of God. That's a part of their handbook of Christian apologetics. You can find it at peterkraft.com. So they list like 20 proofs on there. And I have noticed with Kraft and Tocelli's list of proofs, when you get more towards the back end of the list, like 15 and on, those arguments do seem to be less persuasive. So I feel like they subconsciously sort of list the arguments from strongest to weakest. I don't know if they intentionally did that, but it sort of feels that way when I read it through their list. For example, I believe argument 19, well, argument 20 is not even an argument. It's just Pascal's wager, which I can think is a very effective reason to believe in God, but I don't consider it a classical proof for God's existence. It's an argument for belief in God. It's not an argument for the existence of God. Now, so number 19 on their list was the argument from common consent. And that's the idea that, well, God exists because the vast majority of human beings have come to believe there is a God. And when the vast majority of human beings believe in something, it's usually true. Therefore, God exists. And of course, the problem with that argument, you know, it's basically 40 million Frenchmen, you know, 40 million Elvis fans can't be wrong. You know, they could, you know, it's true. There are a lot of things that human beings have a majority belief in that we would all agree are true, like that the external world exists, things like that. Other minds exist. But there's been other cases where the majority of human beings have been mistaken about something. An example might be belief in geocentrism. The majority of human beings at one point believed that the sun moved around the earth and the earth was stationary. And so they were wrong about that. To Kreeft and Tocelli's credit, they do attempt to answer this objection. They say, well, the majority of human beings were wrong about heliocentrism, but they experienced the sun, the earth, and motion. They just misattributed the motion. Though I think an atheist could fire back and say, you're right. A majority of people experience something they call God. They just misattribute its source from being an actual God to some kind of internal element of their being. So kudos to them for giving it a try to defend it. I don't think it's that great. And there are others, of course, that I would consider in this kind of lower tier of less effective. I don't know if you wanted to discuss those.
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of curious. So from your perspective, obviously, you have that kind of a groupthink idea, right? You know, more people are starting to think, they talk, they persuade each other to believing in something. And the more you tell yourself you're right, you start to believe it, right? And so I think you see a little bit of that coming on board with that. What from your perspective is most compelling about this that might, somebody who sees that and is like, God exists, I believe. What would compel somebody to draw that conclusion? What's the strong point of this argument? Yeah,
I would say that the strong point from the argument from common consent is that not that it proves that God exists, but I think the argument from common consent is a good argument against the atheistic idea that belief in God is delusional, that belief in God is as silly as belief in Santa Claus or belief in unicorns or belief in that Harry Potter really exists. We don't have comparable experience of a universal acceptance of the divine among different populations. I mean, if every culture on earth came up with a story like Batman, I would be highly motivated to believe that Batman was some kind of real thing they're tapping into. It's also the reason why I believe that mathematical objects have a real existence, because every culture on earth comes up with mathematics in a uniform way, and they're all the same. So that leads me to believe math is not something human beings merely invented as a kind of useful fiction. So when it comes to religion, of course, now the atheist may say, yeah, everybody comes up with a belief in religion or the transcendent, but they're all very different. So how could you say there is a corresponding object when you've got Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, they all view God or the divine very differently. And my reply to that would be, well, imagine you're at a party with 100 people and 95 of them say they heard a loud noise outside, but they disagree about the noise. Some say it was a voice, some say it was an explosion. 95 say there was a sound, but they disagree on what the sound was. And 5 of them say there was no sound at all. I would say it's in that case, it would be more likely there was a sound and the 95 have just some have correctly incorrectly understood what it was, but there still was something out there. I'm not inclined to believe the five people who didn't hear it just because the 95 disagree. So I would say the argument from common consent, it's not a great argument for the existence of God, but it's a good argument to take the question of the existence of God seriously.
Yeah, that's good insight. And it obviously directs you down a path of, okay, maybe this deserves some further investigation at a minimum. You look at everybody, all the different religions who believe in some level of a, you know, some form of a deity, while they disagree on what that deity may or may not be, it at least prompts an investigation further, which would potentially take you into maybe a mid-level argument. So let's move into that area and that arena, Trent. What would you say is a good kind of, you know, next level argument that is often levied to show God's existence?
Well, I think it's, I am so sorry about this. Okay. I think that it would be a tie between the moral argument for the existence of God and the Kalam cosmological argument for the existence of God. And that was what I would call mid-tier. So the lower tier arguments, I would say I've never tied up with them would be the common consent argument and the ontological argument. You know, God exists by definition because of what God is. It's a fascinating argument, but I've never really heard of anyone converting to believe in God because of it. Now, the mid-tier arguments, I have heard of many people converting and coming to believe in God through these arguments, through the belief that there is a universal moral law that can only be explained by a universal moral lawgiver, and the belief that the universe began to exist at a finite point in the past, and therefore the universe had a cause for its existence. That would be the Kalam cosmological argument. Now, I would say these two arguments, I give them the rank of mid-level because on their positive side or the pros, they're easy to articulate. They have a lot of persuasive power and they're easy for a lot of people to wrap their heads around. I think that's why C.S. Lewis, who was a wonderful communicator, chose in his book Mere Christianity, he eschewed cosmological arguments for the existence of God and focused on a moral argument for a universal moral law because people can wrap their heads around that when other high-level philosophy can be difficult to grasp. Same with the Kalam argument. I think many people, when they think, oh, if there was a Big Bang or a beginning of the universe, they naturally intuit that if there is a beginning to something, there is a cause for that thing. What could the cause of physical reality be if not some infinite being or non-physical causal reality beyond that? They naturally intuit God as an ultimate cause of the universe coming to be from nothing. So that would be the pros I would have for the moral argument and for the Kalam cosmological argument. The cons I would have for those arguments would be that they've almost become so popular that atheists kind of have this familiarity with them that breeds contempt. Like, oh yeah, I heard that one, but it's been refuted. And you've got, oh my goodness, you've got probably thousands of hours of content on YouTube for both of those arguments.
Yeah.
And professional philosophers have very cogent objections to those arguments, even religious philosophers, because St. Thomas Aquinas did not accept the Kalam cosmological argument, while St. Bonaventure during that same time period did. So you can have their mid-level in that they've got a lot of strengths, but people also levy a lot of weaknesses and objections to the arguments, so much so that to move them from the mid-level tier to something higher, sometimes you have to tweak the arguments a bit. So you take the Kalam argument and tweak how you show the past is finite, or you tweak that the moral argument, instead of morality in general, you say, well, there's this particular feature of morality that is difficult to explain, like the fact that we have moral knowledge as beings who merely evolved, or that there are moral obligations we have to each other. So that's where one reason I put them as kind of a mid-tier arguments.
Yeah. You know, the moral argument's an interesting one. I think we're in an area of, you know, just an era of time right now where morality is something that's obviously hotly debated, hotly questioned. You know, we see that even with the events of 2020.
Sure.
You know, so to somebody, because I've gotten in discussions with people about this particular aspect, and the relativist moral compass kind of comes out where it's, you know, the morality is you know, it's something that has been born out of a necessity as culture has advanced, right? This idea that you know, it's utilitarian ethics, ultimately. Ethical codes and conducts for the thriving of humanity, that has somehow been perceived to be good. And so that's just an evolution, a natural progression of how humans have just kind of evolved into this greatest good for the greatest number. Have you heard that kind of in objection to this? And how would you respond to something like that?
Right. So there's this idea that, well, we can explain morality. You know, we can show, oh, well, it just has a natural element to it. And that's where I think is one of the problems with the moral argument is that, one, some people will just deny the premise there is a universal moral law, though. Yeah. I don't think that people can really hold on to that very long, because when you really press them, they do end up saying that some things are always wrong, especially if they are concerned about the plights of marginalized peoples. You know, I might say to them, is it, you know, well, what's interesting, sometimes I turn the table on these individuals when I'm speaking to them. So sometimes these same people, they disagree with me on an issue like abortion, and they think abortion is fine. And so I might say to them, okay, is it always wrong to try to outlaw abortion? And what's funny is they'll say, well, yeah, people, a woman has a right to do what she wants with her body. Okay, well, now you're leaving relativism and you're espousing a universal prescript here that it's always wrong to take away someone's legal ability to have an abortion or something. So I just don't think people can hang on to that as well. Now, I do think the moral argument, in order to make it a strong argument, you have to show that morality simply cannot be derived from these natural explanations. So you gave the idea here, well, what about utilitarianism? Morality is just about maximizing well-being for people. And so people might gravitate towards a ethical theory like utilitarianism, saying, well, we don't need God. We just know that pleasure is good and pain is bad. And we don't need God to tell us not to rape. And that's one objection to the moral argument, at least when it's presented at a basic level. Yeah. Some atheists are offended. You know, well, I don't need God to know rape is wrong and murder is wrong and stealing. We just know we shouldn't hurt each other. And I would say, you're right, you don't need to know God to have your personal knowledge that these things are wrong. Just like a indigenous person does not have to have knowledge of the respiratory system in order to breathe. He just naturally is able to breathe. He doesn't have to know how the respiratory system works to act on the instinct to breathe, just like you and I don't have to know the ultimate foundation of morality to act on moral instincts we have that certain actions are wrong. The question is, how do we know some instincts are good and other instincts are bad? What determines which ones are moral and which ones aren't? So when you go to utilitarianism, there's lots of ways to show that the principle, well, just do whatever maximizes utility or well-being, is not a great principle. A good short story, well, it's a kind of a short philosophical fiction. It was written in 1973. It's called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, O-M-E-L-A-S. The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. And it's about this paradise called Omelas, where everyone's happy, everything's perfect, everything's great. It's a paradise, a utopia. And then at the end of it, the kicker is they reveal the reason everything is happy is because one child is kept in filth and poverty and suffering. And one child is basically tortured in this way and kept in this way in the dark. And it's an awful, horrible thing. This one child suffers so that everybody else in Omelas can be perfectly happy. And by utilitarianism, if all other things being considered, if that generates the most happiness, that would be the right thing to do. But the short story is an interesting way to, and it talks about at the end about the people who walk away, that some people, when they see the child, they say, oh, well, that's sad, but that's what we need to make this place a paradise, so it all works out. Yeah. But then others are not willing to accept that, and they are the ones who walk away. So it's short. It could take you about 15 minutes to read. It's by Ursula Le Guin. I would definitely recommend it. And trivia, the word Omelas, she got the idea, just she was driving and saw a signpost for Salem, Oregon, and she just named the city. It's just Salem backwards. Philosophers, when you try to come up with names, it's like, It's kind of like when Tolkien, they asked Tolkien, how do you come up with names for all your characters? Like, well, I try to find words that just sound nice. So let's take a cellar door. Cellar door is so beautiful. A cellar door. Open the cellar door. Cellar door. Ah, they're from the kingdom of Cellador. but I digress. So
I love it. Awesome. Well, I think the point that you're hitting on too is something that I've thought about is you take it that layer deeper of you. There's still these moral instincts, right? There's these things that are fundamental. It's where do those come from? Because even if it's from a personal perspective or you're going the utilitarian route, there's something on a deeper level that you're operating with an instinct of. And I think it gets to this thought too of like, you don't stop there. Don't stop at just a moral argument. Again, that's one advocation for this thing. Let's take a look deeper, which would get us potentially into this, kind of advanced argumentation or things that might be the most compelling from your perspective, Trent. What would be the most compelling argument that you see the most most mileage with when it comes to God's existence?
Right. I think two arguments that I think are very compelling, I put them at a top tier, not to disparage, of course, the other arguments, which I have used because I find they have widespread appeal, like the moral argument or the Kalam argument, would be particular kinds of cosmological arguments, arguments from the universe. But unlike the Kalam argument, they're not based on trying to prove the universe began in the finite past. In fact, I would say when it comes to the Kalam cosmological argument, trying to prove the universe began, therefore it has a cause, that cause is God, I would say a lower tiered version of that is the one that tries to use scientific evidence to show the universe began to exist, because scientific evidence is very tentative, and the theoretical physics surrounding the idea of whether the universe began or whether it was a multiverse or other things like that, it quickly goes above people's pay grades. And to rely on that tentative scientific evidence, I think it can serve as a signpost for sure to explore the issue. But that scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe, I don't think it's as solid as philosophical evidence, especially the kind that Alex Pruss has argued for with something called causal finitism. Alex has tried to show, he's a philosopher at Baylor University here in Texas. He has shown, I believe, that causal chains cannot be infinite in length. And if that is true, then the causal chains that make up the past of the universe could not be infinite, and so the past could not be infinite. But so we're getting into philosophical arguments, but even here, people object to those arguments, like St. Thomas Aquinas did, by trying to say that, well, no, you can't philosophically prove that it's impossible for the past to be infinite. Now, the other cosmological arguments, like the argument from contingency or motion, they don't start with that controversial premise the universe began. It just says, look, it starts with premises that are much less controversial. And that's good for an argument. When you want to make a deductive argument, you want to have as least controversial premises as possible. So the argument from contingency says, hey, things exist. Well, that's pretty obvious. And then the next thing is, things could have been different. And we all have very deep intuitions that things could have been different. We get mad when somebody doesn't invite us to lunch. When someone at the office didn't ask us what we wanted at lunch. Imagine if they said, well, it couldn't have been different anyways. Everything is necessary. Well, no, we have this sense that, oh, things could have been different. Why are things the way they could be? Yeah, there is stuff now. There could have been less stuff. Or could there have been nothing? That goes to the age-old question, why is there something rather than nothing? And so there, we're just, you're right. That's a big question. The argument from motion asks the question, not only is there something, but it's moving and changing. That seems obvious. But how does it change? Like, how is that possible that something could be one thing and then become another thing? How does it change? It can't change itself, because that seems like a contradiction, just like it'd be a contradiction to create yourself. It must be changed by something else. Then here, that argument from infinity, it's easier to apply that infinite changers or infinite contingent things don't explain the whole series. So a pro here is that, a few pros. Number one, they at least start out with premises that are not that controversial. Number two, the arguments, I think, have more appeal to atheists because atheists have not been exposed to them as much. And so they're more open to hearing them. They're not as familiar, and thus there's not as much contempt or, you know, oh, I've been there, done that. The next point I would raise is that, number three, the arguments from motion and contingency have an easier time getting you to divine attributes, that I would say these arguments ultimately show there is an infinite necessary being, or there is a being that is just pure actuality. And so what's great about these arguments is it's easy to deduce God's infinite attributes from the ultimate infinite causes that the argument's conclusions naturally lead to. Though I will say another con is that these arguments, you know, there is no easy argument for the existence of God because, you know, it's a complex subject. They can, as you drill down into them, become more complicated. But I do think the other three points that I raised before do raise them high up in the tier, and I've enjoyed sharing them with others. That's why I made a contingency argument and the argument for motion one of my key arguments in a debate I recently had with Alex O'Connor, the cosmic mm-hmm. skeptic. And I thought that yeah. debate went over very well. In fact, Alex didn't even touch my argument for motion and barely interacted with the contingency argument. So I think they're quite powerful arguments.
Yeah, I saw the debate. That was great. It was good to see, obviously, him being of his renown in kind of the atheist world, atheist thought, and have him articulate it against those arguments. Mm-hmm. You know, for contingency and everything, and even motion, they kind of stem from this similar foundation, right? This causal chain of events,
right.
Potentially. You know, I've heard a lot of skeptics claim even that the universe kind of has always existed in this oscillation state. There didn't necessarily need to be some beginning, but it exists in this oscillation state, or matter has always kind of existed. So there was no need for some sort of beginning. What would your, I guess, response be to that? Is it, you know, is there any kind of validity to that?
Well, I think there's two ways to go about it. You could attempt to show that there does need to be a beginning by taking arguments that show an infinite past leads to mm-hmm. contradictions. You could take that route with the person. But if you don't feel like it, you could say, well, and that's what Thomas Aquinas does in his five ways. He says, look, let's suppose for the sake of the argument, the universe mm-hmm. has always existed. We would still have a lot of questions. Imagine if I said to you, hey, look at this spoon. It's a pretty interesting spoon, right? Did you know this spoon has always existed? This has existed for all eternity, this yeah. particular spoon. And I'm sure you'd have other questions like, well, why or how or why is it a spoon instead of a fork? It wouldn't really be compelling if I said, why are you asking that? It's just it's always existed. So there's no other questions we have to ask. And we could say the same thing for the universe, that this universe, even if it's always existed, some people may say, well, the different things in it haven't always existed, but the fundamental particles have always existed. But even there, I was reading an article recently on particle physics, and they mm-hmm. asked different physicists the question, what is a particle? And they couldn't give, they didn't give a uniform answer. Physicists don't have actually a uniform definition of what mm-hmm. a particle is. Is it fundamentally, is it a mathematical point? Is it an irreducible object? Is it something like a string that vibrates according to a dimensional frequency? They don't know. So they have these different questions. And so one, the problem right there is saying, well, it could be a particle. We don't even know what particles are per se. So that leads to questions. Why do we have all these particles in the first place? And number two, we could certainly imagine the particles are different. So for example, let's just suppose the fundamental elements of matter of the universe are quarks. And I believe actually the word quark given to these particles comes from James Joyce's novel Ulysses. There's like Ulysses is a weirdo. It's a great stream of consciousness novel. It's weird to listen to on Audible because it's just Irish people running off the mouth of whatever pops in their head. But it's a very famous novel. And I believe it's Ulysses. I could be wrong where it's from. But there's a line in there, three quarks for Mr. Mork. And so it's just a weirdo word in there. And it's a great word to describe a weirdo particle. So we have quarks, and physicists identify, I think, like six different types with different properties, up, down, their spin, color. They give them these properties, these fundamental quarks. And I would say, well, seems like there could have been more or less of these fundamental elements. They don't appear to be necessary in any way. So the fact, just saying it's always been around, it doesn't answer the question, why for all eternity has there been something instead of nothing? Why is that the case? And why is it this something instead of another kind of something? These are questions that demand answers that I think the arguments for motion and contingency ultimately lead to. The answer is something, a necessary being, something that can't fail to exist, explains why things that can fail to exist are here. And a being that is pure actuality explains a being that changes everything, moves everything, but doesn't change or receive motion from anything, explains why there's a universe of change and motion. The answers to these questions ultimately lead to an infinite and ultimate cause, or what we call God.
Yeah, you know, there's so much that you could dive into there. That, you know, we're only breaking the surface in this episode too, and I think a lot of obviously these arguments for God's existence, you know, these are just showing in a lot of ways, you know, a necessary first cause, right? Rather than, you know, drawing the extension, just for those of you who are listening, rather than drawing the extension all the way to the Christian faith. There's another a couple episodes that you got to look at here. So, but at least getting to the point of saying, you know what, it probably makes sense that there is a necessary first being that caused the whole of existence to come into being and come into motion.
Right.
You know, as we wrap things up here, Trent, I'm just kind of curious. We talked about three, a mid-tier, a low-tier, and a high-tier kind of arguments for God's existence. Just to kind of wet our whistles a little bit here.
Sure.
What, in your opinion, is the best argument against the existence of God? And I'm going to use some language that I hear you use on Catholic Answers quite a bit. Mm. Where do you find it lacking, or where do you find it wanting?
Sure. I think what's interesting is the two arguments that have the most promise for disproving the existence of God would be the ones that Thomas Aquinas put forward in the Summa. He raised two arguments against the existence of God, and to this day, they still remain the strongest arguments. One would be the problem of evil. That's a perennial argument. I think it is the strongest emotionally, that evil and suffering have the capacity to be a place where people fall into despair and give up on God. Yeah. So I do believe they can be the strongest, especially emotionally, though I think the argument from evil fails because no atheist could carry the burden of proving God does not have sufficient reasons for allowing evil to exist. And the moral argument can help in that it gives us an objective grounding for the concept of evil itself as distinct from suffering or unwanted suffering. So that would be my problem with the problem of evil, is that I think that that if we only had evil as the evidence, God's existence would be very unlikely. But when you balance that against everything else, the scale still tilts to God's favor. The other one would just be, this would be probably like what Graham Oppie has put forward. He's probably one of the best atheists out there today, is basically saying that, and this Aquinas also mentioned this argument too, that God is an unnecessary hypothesis. He becomes redundant, that there are simpler explanations for reality that don't require an appeal to the supernatural, and we should go with those simpler explanations. So imagine we can hypothesize a simple fundamental element of reality that explains everything but does not have divine attributes, and so that can supplant God. Now, ultimately, I don't think these arguments work because you can't get this ultimate element of reality to be something that is not the traditional concept of God. But they have promise for sure in that regard. So I would say those two arguments, the problem from evil and the attempt to make naturalism the simplest, or in jargon terms, most parsimonious explanation. But I think the arguments for God, when they are all put together, do stand to be convincing alternatives to these atheistic arguments.
Awesome. Trent, well, this has been awesome having you on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time. Where can our listeners find out more about you and get to see more of your work?
Sure. I would recommend they could check out my podcast, The Council of Trent. That's available on iTunes and Google Play. They can become premium subscribers at trenthornpodcast.com. My books are available at online book retailers. When it comes to the existence of God, I have my book, Answering Atheism. If you'd like a book to give away to an atheist to explain Catholicism, the best book out there would probably be my book, Why We're Catholic, because I wrote it for non-Catholics. If you'd like to dive into the topic of atheism, some great books on this subject. Answering Atheism would be a start. If you want to go deeper, I would recommend Ed Fazer's book, Five Proofs. The Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology is a hefty book, but it does cover a lot of these arguments. It's a bit more of an advanced reader. I think there's a few other books out by Ignatius Press, one called Who Designed the Designer? That is another good one in that regard. Lots of great stuff. Also, if you want to go deep on understanding atheism for and against, my friend John DeRosa has a great podcast called the Classical Theism Podcast that I would recommend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.